From in the beginning to the musical apocalypse, this is The Bible Says What. I'm your host, Mike Wiseman, and on today's episode, I talk with Stephanie Clark, author of The Sex Goddess, Debunking the Mythology of God and Sex. The Bible claims that the body is a temple for the Holy Spirit, 1 Corinthians 6, 19-20. It even goes as far as to say that we are not our own, that we were bought at a price, and that we should honor this deity who purchased us with our bodies, or Yahweh's temples. In other words, because we are owned by the Christian deity, we must follow his defined parameters for sex, his idea of what should or should not be done in the privacy of one's own bedroom. But today's guest believes something completely different. Let's start the show.
Is there anything in the Bible that you yourself have an issue with? Okay, so it took you reading the Bible to realize that those things were bad for you?
Yeah, it actually did.
Couldn't figure this out on your own?
No, Ted Bundy could be redeemed. God doesn't kill children.
What do you think the Passover was? Yahweh sets up a whole system in the Old Testament where you slaughter animals just so he's able to forgive you.
So today we have Stephanie Clark, the author of The Sex Goddess, Debunking the Mythology of God and Sex. So glad you're here today. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.
Could you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about yourself so we can know you a little better? Oh, and your book,
sure.
Too. And your book, of course.
Well, thank you. So we're talking now. I'm in South Africa, and I started my first church here. It was the first New Thought multiracial ministry in South Africa, which I set up to heal the wounds of apartheid. Hmm. So in South Africa, we had apartheid from 1948 until 1994, when Mandela came to power as the president of a democratic South Africa. And my church, I started in the year 2000. So I studied in America, I studied in Los Angeles, and I'm not from South Africa, actually. I don't know if you can tell by my accent, but I was born in Britain.
No.
And yeah, really. I was born in Britain, but my mom emigrated. And when I was 27, I came out to visit her just for a two-month holiday. And I thought I would hate the politics in South Africa because it was 1985. And so it was in the last few years of apartheid at that time. Hmm. But at that time, no one could ever have guessed that we would have a democratic constitution within the next 9 years or so. Hmm. At that time, it looked like there would be a civil war and it would be a bloodbath, and basically the white people would be decimated because the blacks had been suppressed by the whites for so long, and naturally they were angry. So when I came to South Africa, as I said, I only expected to stay 2 months, but I found the spiritual teaching that I'm now a minister in, and the teaching is called The Science of Mind.
Okay.
So the basis of that was Christian Science. That was the Mary Baker Eddy and the Christian Scientists. That was the beginning of the philosophy. But we call it sometimes the science of mind and spirit. We call it New Thought and Ageless Wisdom. So it's the perennial spiritual philosophy. I found the teaching and I realized this was the teaching that I wanted to go deeper in. I was searching spiritually up until this point, and I'd gone to a number of different churches and different esoteric groups. And when I heard the Science of Mind teacher giving a class, I just knew this is for me. So I went to America to study to be a minister, and I spent 10 years in Los Angeles. Most of those years were with Reverend Michael Beckwith from the Agape community. I'm sure you're familiar with his work. Hmm. He was a member of the team that was on The Secret, which was filmed in, I think, it came out in 2006. So I decided, and when I got to America and I saw Reverend Michael Beckwith, he's an African-American, and I saw that he had created what I wanted to create in South Africa, It was when I found the teaching of the science of mind and I started attending the church services on a Sunday, it was very apparent to me that only white people were there in the church. And the teaching is a teaching of oneness. It's a teaching of unity and universality and that we're all created equal. And then suddenly I see, interesting. Hmm. It's a very schizophrenic society, South Africa, where, you know, there are two, it's like two, living in two different worlds, the white world and the black world. Less so nowadays, of course, but in those days, definitely the two races were kept separate. So right. I had a vision for a multiracial ministry, which at that time was illegal. I wasn't a minister at that time, of course. It was within my first few months of studying the science of mind, I felt the call to ministry, and I had a vision for a multiracial ministry that would heal the wound of apartheid.
Sorry, can I stop you for a second there? What is the science of mind exactly? You said it was the teaching of oneness. Is that mainly what it is? It just teaches that we're all one?
There's a bit more to it than that. So the founder of the science of mind teaching was a man named Ernest Holmes. Mm-hmm. And he was born in the late 1800s on the East Coast of America. And he was a churchgoer and he questioned everything and he read very widely. He studied all the world religions and the important world philosophies. And he came up with this teaching or this version of truth called the science of mind. And he says every religion has truth in it. And his mission was to articulate the truth in every religion. And what's for me fascinating is that, which I had never really grasped from my exposure to Christian theology, was that the mind is really important and the mind is our creative element. And we are creators just as the divine creator created the planet. So our minds are the creative energy that create our experience. Hmm. So when Jesus said it's done unto you as you believe, the science of mind interpretation of that is that my deeply held beliefs are the, my deeply held beliefs are the things that are going to make my experience what it is. So very simply, it's not just positive thinking, but very simply, if I believe that I'm a success and that everything goes my way, I'm going to have that experience. And if I believe that I'm a miserable, wicked sinner and I'm not worthy to, you know, I'm the piece of dust on the ground, whatever, then that will also be my experience. So according to my belief, it is done unto me. And I've seen that
I see. So yeah, my mom thinks the same thing. She says, if you speak it, it will be, you know, type thing. Is that kind of what it is?
Yes, that's also related. So we have the power to think, to believe, and to speak. And when you and I speak from that sense of conviction that what we are speaking is the creative word, and that the law of the universe goes into action on that word and makes it manifest as a physical experience.
Oh,
yes,
I wish that was true. Man, that would be awesome. I mean, I can sit here and talk about $1 million all I want, but it's not going to happen. You know what I mean? Is there limitations on it? How does that work? That seems a little far fetched to me.
Okay, so that's, I understand why you would have that reaction. It does seem far-fetched, and a lot of people had that critique about the movie The Secret, you know, just affirm it and it will be, just say that it's the truth and it will be the truth.
Right, I mean, so, that'd be awesome. That sounds like a superpower of some kind, though, you know, kind of like faith with the Christians, you know.
Yeah, no, it is awesome, and the thing that makes our spoken word. So say, look, let's do an experiment here. So I speak the word and declare that I am now the possessor of $1 million, that I am the one who I now create $1 million and manifest it instantly and right now.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it does. Okay.
Where do I start training for this?
You don't believe it and nor do I. That's the thing. So if you don't believe it, you can't have it. Oh. But if you believe it, you can have it. Yeah, but you can't believe something that goes against the law of the universe. So you can't believe that rain will fall upwards, for example, because that would counteract the law of gravity.
So impossible things.
Yeah, that would be impossible because it would go against the natural laws.
Gotcha.
But it's right and good for you and I to prosper, to be prosperous and to prosper others.
Right.
To have as much abundant life as we can willingly and happily accept. Mm-hmm. So that's it. It's all about the acceptance of this as the truth of being. And it's not about like God is God is your banker. You could say that God is your banker. It's, when we talk about manifesting $1 million, is it for example, is it for your own selfish needs? Or is it to pay back a debt? Is it to feel like you've got power? All of those would be, for me, false motivations, and they probably would backfire and you probably wouldn't get your $1 million. But if you want to manifest $1 million because you've got this fabulous idea for a project that's going to benefit humanity, that $1 million probably
come
your way.
Or save a child's life, you know, like pay for a hospital, be able to save a child's life.
Exactly.
You know, stuff like that, speaking into existence. There's a lot of people that don't have money to do those things or feed their children. There's a lot of children starving out there. I'm sure there's a lot of people that could really use that superpower, you know. I mean, that sounds pretty awesome.
Well, everyone can access it. And the two examples you just gave are really good because to have money to provide food for a child or to provide medical help for a child or anybody to provide medical help. So you've got to get clear on what it is you want to manifest. So in this case, maybe a medical operation is going to cost $1 million. Do you need $1 million or do you need a medical operation? You need a medical operation.
Okay.
So it's possible that you get funding or that the surgeon says, I want to experiment.
Right.
It happened with
possible.
My mother.
It's possible, but it doesn't always happen, though, you know. It's possible. There's people that believe that they can speak to God and have things healed for them, and they believe that this is happening. My mother's one of them. She believes that if you speak it and you believe it, it will happen. Mm. And I've seen so many times it not happen.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean what are those cases? Is it just not enough? I mean, I don't know if you use faith. Do you use faith or how does that work?
Yeah, for me, faith is my belief that the laws of the universe work accurately, perfectly, and impersonally all the time. Hmm. So gotcha. If I'm, for example, maybe someone who I love is dying, okay, and I speak my word that this person shall stay alive. I cannot influence somebody else's spiritual path. I cannot do that. I cannot do that for my own personal emotional needs. And I cannot determine what another shall experience. And I also cannot manipulate and control my universe to suit me. All I can do is align with the spiritual power within me and open up to the highest outcome, the best possible version of reality that I can accept. So to pray for someone to live so that I can feel better, so that I don't have to experience grief or loss, is for me working against the laws of the universe. If that person, if it's their time to go, it's their time to go.
So you just let it happen. You just let nature take its course type thing.
And in that particular example that I gave you.
Gotcha. All right. Well, let's get into your book. What? Let's talk about that. The Sex Goddess, Debunking the Mythology of God and Sex. Tell us a little bit about it.
Okay. So I couldn't help noticing that in most religious places, sex was avoided. And I knew that people think about sex a lot. Whether they're getting it or not getting it, they still think about it. And I remember hearing on a radio show one time that one of the radio show guests was saying that men think about sex once every 7 seconds.
Yeah. And so that's baloney. I decided right now. That's baloney. It ain't that often.
So it's not that often. Okay, so maybe it depends on.
Yeah, maybe a teenager.
Okay,
you know?
Maybe teenagers. But interestingly, I decided to check it out. I used to be a massage therapist. And so I heard this radio show, and then I had a client coming over later to have a massage. And I thought, I'll just run it by him because he was talking about sex a lot with me. Uh-uh. And so I said, I heard this. Is it true that men think about sex once every 7 seconds? And he said, yes, it's true. And the other 6 seconds, too.
Good grief.
I guess everybody has a different different appetite and different...
everybody's different, definitely.
Different, different amount of mental attention that they place on sex and sexuality and looking for sex or experience sex.
Get that man a hobby. Good grief. Anything.
Yeah, and look, it changes with age and it changes with circumstances, and all of those things make a difference to how much time people devote to sex. But the thing is, in churches typically, or in religious institutions, it's not really discussed. And maybe for couples who are about to get married, maybe there'll be some information for them about sexuality.
Very taboo. You know, very taboo.
Yeah, exactly. The sexuality, the laws and the rules and the mythology about sexuality that we've inherited from the Bible is really very anti-life, as far as I'm concerned. It's not about sex as something pleasurable, something that takes place between intimate equal partners. Mm-hmm. It's often about the woman is supposed to be a virgin until she's married. The man's, you know, allowed to sow his wild oats, and that's okay. I mean, why are there two different rules for the sexes? And I have my own theory about that, which I present in the book, which I'm happy to go into now if you want to go that direction.
Of course, yes, let's do it.
Okay, so
I'm intrigued.
There was a time before the male patriarchal mythology was invented, when the goddess ruled supreme. So there's not much written about that. In fact, there's very little written about the goddess worship, because we're talking prehistory. So the first historical religious documents were in Mesopotamia, 3500 BCE. So before that, the goddess was worshipped for thousands of years. And the way that we know that today is because there is archaeological evidence about that. So there's a goddess figurine that was discovered in Lower Austria, Venus of Willendorf, and she has big busts, big belly, big hips, and she was worshipped as a female creator goddess. Hmm. So what was considered beautiful and attractive before women had to be stick figures was the women who were voluptuous and clearly very fertile, clearly very sexual. The goddess was men worship women. They believe that women could create life independently. Before human beings understood that the man had to fertilize, the male sperm had to fertilize the egg, they saw that women gave birth and they didn't understand the male's role in that. So they just thought women somehow gave birth magically and independently. They believed that the blood coagulated in the womb of a woman and became an embryo, and then it became a child that was born.
Interesting.
So they made the assumption that if women created babies, then this planet must have been created by a great mother, like a great mother goddess who created the planet and the animals and the plants and all the people upon it. And they also believed that the great mother goddess, that she created the planet by the blood coagulating in her womb, and then that from that the planet was born. So later men worship women, and also because men understood that blood, if you lose blood, you die. I mean, blood is the essence of life, right? Mm. So they saw that women could bleed and not die, and they thought, women must be really magical creatures. They saw that women could turn off the bleeding when they were pregnant, and they saw that women could turn off the bleeding when they became older and no longer were in a position to have babies. Mm. So they just thought, this is a magic. Not only are women magical beings, but the blood that the child is born from must be magical creative substance. So they thought menstrual blood was magical creative substance. And
I never thought about that. You know, they must have really thought women were magical creatures. That's pretty funny to think about. Nice job.
Well, they thought women were magical creatures because we are.
Well, I mean, yeah, it's pretty amazing. You know, the bleeding, the whole life-giving thing is just amazing to me. Just grow a whole life inside of you. That is.
That's right.
I can totally imagine before we figured anything out how everything was just magical to these people.
That's right,
put women on those pedestals. Yeah. Good job.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So men and women both. Pardon me?
I'm sorry. Is this all of them, or is this a certain tribe, or is this a particular deity that was worshipped, or Which particular group are we talking about here?
So I'm talking about ancient Europe and the ancient Near East.
Gotcha.
So the biblical territory and also ancient Europe. That's the goddess figurine that I'm talking about was dated Venus of Willendorf. She was dated at 28,000 BCE. So there's also a goddess figurine that's been found in Turkey of Catalhoyuk, and she's 6,000 BCE.
Yeah, so, they have a lot of goddess fertility goddesses.
That's around, right, yeah. Fertility goddesses, yeah. So then, approximately 5,000 years ago, some tribes invaded from the south of Russia, the Caucasus area. They invaded Europe and the ancient Near East, and they came with a warlike god. And it's possible that when these tribes invaded, it wasn't about territory. It was a religious crusade. So they came with a male warlike god, and they gradually infiltrated. They occupied the territories where the goddess had been worshipped. And they didn't obliterate the goddess culture, but they gradually infiltrated. So whereas at one time there was a single goddess in the heavens who created male and female, gradually this goddess was given a lower stature, and we have a male god in the heavens who has a goddess as his consort. Gradually then the male god became the only god in the heavens, and the female goddess consort started to disappear. So there was a gradual evolution leading to the full and complete and only power of a male god in the heavens. And as that evolution occurred, so too on earth, it was reflected in the societal structure. So whereas at one time when the goddesses worshipped, the priestesses who worked in the goddess's temple were the religious and the political leaders of the societies where they were. So that the whole rule of the priestesses then fell away, and gradually male priests took over where the priestesses had once ruled. And then it became illegal for the priestesses to practice their rituals and their ceremonies in the temple. The priests then threatened to kill the women if they continued to practice the goddess religion. And so what the women did is they practiced their ceremonies outside the temples in the forests or in nature. And guess what? Soon they became known as witches. Huh. That's the origin of the witch, the woman who insists on practicing her ceremonies and her rituals and has been banned by the male establishment. Yeah.
Huh. I'll have to look into that. That's pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So what god do you believe in? What specific is it a goddess? Is it a obviously, probably not a male figure.
That's so sensitive of you.
Who is God to you? And what is God?
Oh, that's a great question, isn't it? It's the eternal question. Right. So according to my teaching, God is not a person.
Uh-huh.
God is a power.
Okay.
And I love the idea of God as a power. So when I was training in the science of mind, the teacher Ernest Holmes said, call God what you need to call God so that it works for you. So if God as Father doesn't work for you, don't call God Father. Call God Creative Mind or Infinite Spirit or Divine Mother Father. I mean, whatever works. So that was right away an enormous freedom for me, because my own father was a violent alcoholic, and I couldn't relate to God as Father in terms of a God of love. That for me was too much of a leap in my imagination, in my mind. So I had a strong, from early childhood, although I wouldn't have been able to articulate it, of course, as a child, but there was always a strong intuition. I always had a strong intuition, a strong psychic sense. Like I knew when people around me were suffering from cancer. I knew that in my lifetime I would find a cure for cancer that would have nothing to do with medical research. And this knowing is, for me, this is how my relationship with God shows up in my particular human individuality. So there's a capacity to tap into universal knowledge or universal awareness that I can then bring through in my own human lifetime. So the divine power, we call it in science of mind divine mind, because it's like a huge intelligence. And when we align with it, as I was talking about before, so when we align with it, then we create our experience in a way that's uplifting and expansive and joyful and loving and prosperous and abundant and all those good things, which Jesus said, I've come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. And that's what I believe he was talking about, that we are here to intelligently create an abundant life for ourselves that not only blesses our life, but blesses the lives of everybody else as well.
So you believe... Okay, I'm a little confused. Which parts of the Bible do you believe? What is the Bible to you? Let's start there. What is the Bible to you?
Oh, gosh. So, well, the Bible is a collection of patriarchal, mythological stories. It's not history, as far as I'm concerned. It's mythology. And what I believe in is the words of Jesus. Jesus articulated universal principles. Huh. And that's where I would... that's what I give weight to. But a lot of the Bible, it's interesting, some historical stuff, but mostly mythological. I cannot accept that a loving God is only male, and I cannot accept that a loving God would allow women to be raped and slaughtered and all of that stuff. And this so-called loving God, Yahweh, so recent archaeological findings have shown that Yahweh had a wife. Her name was Asherah.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so Yahweh was in partnership with a female goddess. But in the Bible we read, I think it's in Elijah. I've written it in my book. Sorry, I can't exactly remember.
No worries.
I think it's in Elijah.
there's a lot of stuff.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Where the Hebrews are encouraged to go and destroy the shrines of the goddess, and they go and destroy the shrine to Asherah.
Right.
So, you know, Yahweh has a goddess, a partner, consort, whom he loves. And at the same time, the monotheistic Yahweh that the Hebrews created with their scriptures then is more than happy to go and destroy his goddess's shrine. And it just doesn't make sense. So, yeah, So, the Hebrews were busy trying to destroy the goddess religions and enforce the worship of Yahweh as the one and only God.
Yeah, well, I think they were trying to destroy all the religions.
Okay, true. Yeah.
I mean, yes, the women were part of that, but so were the men. It was no distinction there. So you believe that Jesus was not myth. Do you believe that he died and rose again?
That's a really interesting question. So he may have lived.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. He may have lived. I believe that the man Jesus, if he lived, was an adept and very skilled at working with energy. Did he rise again? Yes, I believe that he knew how to manipulate his energy bodies successfully enough to be able to manifest himself to his disciples after his crucifixion.
Okay, I'm just going to ask a very weird question here. I'm sorry, but what's an energy bodies?
Okay, so we look at... Okay, thank you for asking. so we look at human bodies as a physical body,
uh-huh.
but actually we don't end with our physical nature. We have a non-physical nature as well, and we have you might have heard the word aura. So we have an aura. We have an energy radiation around us. So you know when someone walks into a room, whether they're grumpy or whether they're happy, no matter before they've even spoken. You sense moods. You know, you say, oh, I like that person's energy, or I like that person's style or whatever. And it's about you're sensing into something that's not physical.
Well, the grumpy guy, so, I mean, typically I can just see it on his face. I can just see his whole mannerisms. And a polite, happy person has different mannerisms and different facial expressions. And I think that's mm-hmm. kind of the energy you might be speaking of, is just that how they act, is how they present themselves, their body language.
Okay, but yeah, that's true. But all of that you're witnessing with your physical eyesight.
Right. And I don't feel a grumpy person in a room. Do you feel a grumpy person in a room?
Yeah, I could.
Yeah? Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't do that. I can see it, but I can't feel it. That's something I don't have. That's interesting.
No, you have it. You just haven't developed it.
Because
everyone has this intuitive capacity to tap into energy vibrations, and everyone has it, but we've typically been trained to shut it down and just look at the physical world from a linear perspective. So if you can't see it, then it doesn't exist.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
that's a very, very scientific approach.
Yeah. Yeah. Typically, I approach the world that way. I can't see it, taste it, feel it, you know, touch it, smell it. I mean, it's pretty much non-existent to me, or, you know what I mean?
So then I have to ask you a question because I'm really curious.
Of course.
So, yeah, you have a scientific approach to reality, which is right and good. I mean, that's, you know, that's part of our evolution, that we're understanding more and more about the natural laws of the universe. We're understanding more about science. And that's right and good. That's, we're using our intelligence for discovery, for learning, for understanding how the universe works. Right. Perfect. So if you have that perspective, then when you asked me that question before about, do I believe that Jesus lived and do I believe that he rose again? Mm-hmm. Then if you have a scientific perspective, how do you see that yourself? What's your particular perspective on the Jesus Christ? Did he live? Did he rise again?
He might have lived. He might have been a real person. I don't know. There's a lot of speculation either way. But I do not believe personally. Don't believe in magic. So I don't believe that he came back from the dead. I don't believe that he healed people by touch. If anything, he was just an eccentric prophet of some sort, you know, thought he was a prophet of Yahweh, just like many other people, I guess. And I'm not real deep in history. You know, I've studied in the past, but that was in the past and my memory isn't the best. But to me, Jesus was just a person that walked the earth and said some things that, even if he did say those things, we don't even know if Jesus said those things, you know? And we aren't even 100% on that. It's like the story of, or the telephone, you know? You tell one person and then it goes down and down, and finally somebody writes it down. Before you know it, you've got a guy that rises from the dead after 3 days, you know? That's kind of my take on it. That's how I see the Jesus story.
That's interesting. You just reminded me of something when you said that I hadn't considered before, so thank you. But before Jesus came to Earth, we think, in goddess religion, so in Egypt, the great mother goddess Isis was the most famous goddess, and she had temples of initiation. I'm sure you've heard of Ephesus in Turkey and Eleusis in Greece. So in the temples of initiation, Isis, in the Isis, I don't want to call it a cult because the religions that want to dominate call the other religions cults.
Right.
So a religion is a religion. And if I don't like your religion, I'm going to call your religion a cult, just to minimize its importance.
They're all kind of cult-like to me.
Okay. All right. Okay, we can talk about cult as well in a minute, but let me just finish this thought.
So
in the Isis religion, people who were spiritually on the path and were wanting to know the secret of eternal life went through an initiation process, and that process typically took 3 days. And in the initiation process, they became stripped of everything that they were attached to in terms of their human life. So they had to go usually into a dark cave or a dark tunnel, and they had to either wear a simple shift or else they were completely naked. They didn't eat any food. They didn't drink any water for that 3-day period. And they came up against all their demons, and it's almost like walking through the valley of the shadow of death. They had to go through that entire experience. And after 3 days, they would come back out into the light and they would have the secret of life. They would get to understand that they are actually not human, that the human identity is just an overcoat that we wear, and essentially we are eternal and immortal beings. So maybe that idea about the 3-day ascension process, or the 3-day process between dying and rising, it comes directly from, I'm thinking aloud. I don't know if that's true, but it maybe comes directly from the journey of the initiate in the old mystery schools pre-Christ.
Interesting.
Maybe.
Well, that may be one of the reasons. I know there's a few of them. I just, you know, can't remember off the top of my head because my memory is crap. But this power you speak of, you say that that your deity is not a person.
Okay, now listen.
Go ahead.
Pastor Mike. So no, I wanted to talk about occult, and then I also, when you said my memory is crap.
Oh yeah, uh huh.
You just created a reality where your memory is crap.
No, it's been that way. Yeah, I mean, I can say my memory is awesome all I want, but then 10 minutes later, I'm not going to remember what I was doing in the kitchen. So.
Yeah, I know. You and I can't change from a negative to a positive in an instant, usually. Sometimes you can, but it's usually quite hard, so you have to go gradually. So I've also noticed there has been some memory loss for me as I've been getting older.
Oh, don't say that. There hasn't been any memory loss for you.
No, I have observed some memory loss as I've gotten older. Uh-huh. But if I say my memory is crap or my memory is rubbish, I'm definitely endorsing that belief, and I'm making it more powerful in my experience. So what I can say is my memory is starting to improve.
There you go.
Yep.
More positive.
Yeah, I'm finding new ways to remember the important things in my life. That could be like a...
You sound just like my mother right now. It's so funny.
Okay.
Oh man! Oh, why are you so negative? A lot of men. Just be more positive.
Okay. Yeah, but we're not. I'm not that kind of. Just be more. I'm not that kind of person, and I'm not that kind of person that says to people, "Just be more positive," because I think that's really flippant.
Right,
I think if someone's
word it differently.
Pardon me.
Word it differently, so it sounds more positive. That's what I'm talking about.
I used to think that I, should tell people how to get their lives together, but I have gotten a little bit more humble as I've grown older, because if I could get my life together, I would, right? You know, so I would prefer to be compassionate with someone if they're going through tough stuff, not agree with them that life is tough, but be compassionate for the feelings that they're experiencing.
Awesome. That's good. That's good. That's good. Always, mm-hmm. Compassion is always a good thing. Empathy.
Yeah,
we need more
right.
empathy in this world. That's for sure.
Yeah. So I just remember that we started to talk about cults, and I want see because
sure.
my memory's getting better all the time. So now I've just remembered that we were talking about cults, and I wanted to give you the definition of cult that I was taught, and that is that a cult is a group of people who are not allowed to expand in consciousness beyond the level of consciousness of the leader.
Hmm.
So the leader actually wants total control over the people's minds, the people that are in his or her cult. And they're not allowed to develop, they're not allowed to think for themselves, they're not allowed to discover their own version of truth or their own spiritual path. They have to do what the leader says, and they have to live by his or her rules. So, and in Science of Mind, Ernest Holmes said something really wonderful. He said, we are open at the top. So no matter how high any one of us goes in consciousness, someone will come along who'll go higher, because it's an eternal, it's an eternal journey of rising in consciousness and rising in awareness, increasing our everyday awareness of who we are as spiritual beings and what the purpose of our life is on earth. So whatever we know now, someone will know something more tomorrow. So whatever pinnacle we've reached today, by tomorrow, it's going to change. And you can really see that with the internet and how fast information spreads. Not that everything on the internet is true or spiritual, but it's an indication of how consciousness can expand all the time. And it's impossible to really put a stop on that. But in a cult, the leader will try to stop people from growing, questioning, even, expanding in their own unique way, which is, I believe, our right as human beings to discover our own theology, our own spiritual path, and our own way of living our best life.
Interesting. Well, I mean, I see that as part of a cult. I don't see that as a cult, though. I mean, as the definition of a cult, I mean, a cult is just a religious people devoted to a particular person, to me. And so that would be Jesus, that would be Yahweh, that would be, whatever it is devoted to. You happen to be devoted to, your deity is a power, a specific power. And I'm very curious about this power. Where is this power? And what does it look like? Does it have a look? Does it have a shape? I mean, can you explain this power to me?
The best word I can use is energy. That's it.
Energy
is everywhere.
Right.
Yeah, it's everywhere. It's in me, within you, all around us. And we couldn't be having this. We couldn't have this conversation unless the power existed.
So where does this?
And there's definitely no.
Sorry, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, you're fine.
No, it's definitely. I said this. There's definitely the power that people call God.
Mm-hmm.
Does, as far as I'm concerned, does not have a human form. But I am God in the flesh. Hmm. So the God within me shows up as a human form that people recognize as Stephanie.
The energy.
The energy.
The energy. Yep. And where does this
life? Okay. Where does it come from?
Yeah. Just dying to ask that one. Where does it come from?
my teacher, Reverend Michael Beckwith, used to ask the same question, like, what came first, the chicken or the egg?
Hmm.
And the answer is consciousness. Consciousness. It's the stuff that we haven't found words for yet.
Okay.
How do you put it into words? As soon as you put it into words, you've somehow put a human limitation on it, and it's something that's unlimited. It's quite hard to have this conversation about something that is abstract in this way.
Undescribable.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's just
if I'm a religious leader and I can describe it for you and you feel safe and you feel like you know what that thing is, then you're going to love me because I'm going to make you feel safe. So to live in the question and to live in the discovery and to live in the not knowing and the not having all the answers is terrifying for most human beings.
It is. Some people find it terrifying. Some people find it annoying. I hate not knowing things. It drives me nuts. Like, if I see something and I don't know, I'm like, wait, why does that do that? What doesn't make any sense? why are you saying these things, you know? So this energy, it just... How do you know it's there? How do you know it's there, and how do you know it does what it does?
Well, that's a great question. So... My first answer is that the teaching Science of Mind, that's the name of the teaching, but the church organization used to be called the Church of Religious Science.
Hmm.
And the reason it was called the Church of Religious Science was because Ernest Holmes believed that we could prove this stuff. We could prove that this stuff works. So that when you change your mind, when you change your deep beliefs, then your physical universe changes accordingly. So I've had many experiences of where I've wanted something, or I've affirmed something, or I've flippantly asked for something and it's manifested for me. And I know that manifestation is a direct result of my thinking, and I've proved it to myself. I don't need to prove it to you or to anyone else, but I've proved it to myself.
Right. Well,
that the way I think.
I've talked to so many Christians that do the same thing with Jesus. They'll ask Jesus for something, and then the proof will be that it happened or they got it. I particularly I've been using George Carlin. It's amazing how effective that's been. George Carlin, I really need this, and it happens. I'm not trying to make fun of what you do, but it's seriously, that's what I've been doing, just as a comparison to Jesus or whatever else people pray to. And it's so funny how often it works. And I could proclaim the name of George Carlin right now. It works. If you ask George Carlin for things, 90% of the times you're going to get it. So, I mean, what's to say that it's not George Carlin doing all this for you? You know what I mean?
That's great. I love how you question. It's so wonderful. So it doesn't matter who you call to. It doesn't matter. If you believe that you can have that thing that you're asking for, it's done unto you as you believe. If you believe that some figure called George Carlin brought it to you, oh, well, that'd be my guess.
Why does it only work 90% of the time then? It's about 80%,
90%. Most people like to believe that it's...
effective.
Yeah, Jesus or some deity, like a lot of Catholics like to pray to the saints.
Yeah.
also, Catholics like to pray to Mary as opposed to Jesus. You know, they prefer. They like the legacy of the goddess. You know, so we're allowed to keep Mary as the watered down virginal representation of the sexual fertile goddess that we used to worship. But yeah, so people like to worship these figures that have been deified and think that they have extra power to bring us what we want. But all, that is very it won't really work, because if you think that there's a power outside yourself that's going to do some magic for you,
mm-hmm. many people
probably
do.
Not going to work. But if
it
you
does
believe
for them though,
yeah, they do.
Yeah.
and it may work, it may not.
You know, people believe that they pray for a safe trip down the road and it happens. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous the things that people pray for and they think they get answered. You know what I mean? So
I don't find it ridiculous. I pray for that when I get in the car. I pray for a safe trip.
Oh.
And in South Africa, it's a really good idea. I mean,
I guess. Yeah. I mean, if it makes you feel better.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, I mean, there's nobody listening, not even George Carlin, no matter how much I want him to be listening and answering my prayers. It's just not him. You know what I mean?
No, but what it is your higher self. It's like the non-physical you, or the divine being in you. Mm. is what you align with when you make those statements or say those prayers. You call it George Carlin, okay, you feel right. Like you need to give it a name of something outside of yourself, but it's not outside of yourself. It's the power within you that you're aligning with. There's a power that you know within you, that's within you, that creates, that's creative.
Mm-hmm.
And when you align with that, you can create whatever you want. And the language that you use isn't so important. It's more about your inner sense of what you're up to here and your inner sense of, I know that if I affirm this, it's actually going to happen. I have a strong sense about that. But on the other hand, you cannot convince yourself if you don't really deeply believe it. That doesn't work.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah.
It doesn't work.
I think my problem is I'm just asking for too much. I'll go down to 100,000 and I'll start practicing on that one, see how that goes.
No, there's no such thing as too much. But it's a very good – what you caught on to was a really good – method for expanding consciousness, and that is that you just ask for, you could even ask for $10. You just ask for something that's like believable to you right now, and then tomorrow you maybe ask for $20, and you just keep moving that way until your consciousness can accept that yes, you can have anything that you ask for.
Until I get some money, and that's the money I was talking about. Yeah, I know. It's cool. It's awesome. I appreciate your time today, though. I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for all your questions. It was really fun. Bless you.
Bye.
Okay. A divine blast. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
That's all the podcast there is for you today. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show and want to help us keep the recording light on or help us upgrade to some better equipment, then stop by the Patreon page today at patreon.com/BSWthePodcast and sign up to be a supporter of the show for as little as $1 an episode. Patrons will get access to patron-only content such as bloopers and unaired clips. As always, you can find us at the Bible Says What Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube pages. Please send all of your questions or hate mail to bswthepodcast@gmail.com. That's bswthepodcast@gmail.com. And no matter which platform you get your podcast from, you can help others find the show and let us know how we are doing by giving us a rating and or comment. While you're there, don't forget to push that subscribe button so you won't miss out on next week's episode. Until then, would you kindly pick up your Bibles and read them?